where we're going. We have up here on the screen just kind of where the forecast or the service. You'll notice that last week we covered one and two of Nehemiah, and today we're covering three and four. Chapters five will be individually covered on February 4th. Six, we'll have the Lord's table on the 6th. So not next week, but the next week after that. Shayla, you're coming up for the 18th and the 25th, and we're going to kind of just capture 11 through 13. Some of these chapters, there's a lot of names listed, you know, in these. They're not really just teachable as far as a fashion like this. So you'll see why we're covering some chapters more than others. I think what's really neat about this book of Nehemiah is hopefully we're presented in a way that when you walk out of here, you're going to feel completely comfortable with the book of Nehemiah. So I think you'll walk out of here thinking, you know, I have a grasp of it, not just for historicity, you know, but why God has the book of Nehemiah to begin with. So anyway, invite you to turn your Bible to the book of Nehemiah or turn it on to the book of Nehemiah. And as you go there, you can see that we covered last week in chapter 1 and 2, who is Nehemiah? He's a slave. Anybody remember what kind of slave? What was his position? He was a cupbearer. He's a cupbearer, so that was a person who would taste of the drink, make sure it wasn't poison before the king. He was a Jew. He was serving a king, an eastern monarch, who ruled over Jerusalem. Jerusalem had fallen into total disrepair. The gates and the walls had been broken down, and over the last period of 90 years, since the Jews were allowed to go back into their conquered city, two large groups had gone in, and then word had gotten to Nehemiah through his brother, while he was a cupbearer to this king who had authority over that whole region, found out that the place was absolutely destroyed. And so Nehemiah asked if he could, he prayed for 4 months. 4 months fasted and prayed, did some calculations, met with some people to determine how much timber he would need to rebuild, and got letters of passage through the different governors, what we call warlords now, the particular area in the forest. The king walked back in and said, Nehemiah, why are you so sad? Nehemiah was like, well, how would you feel if the land of your forefathers has been turned asunder? And the king said, well, what is it that you want? So then the king gave him leave to go to Jerusalem and also gave him a large military detachment to travel with him. So here's Nehemiah, goes from one place of what I would think is considerable comfort, a place where he's existing as a slave. The next thing you know, he is off and running as the rebuilder of Jerusalem and a city that would be pivotal in the introduction of Christianity. So, kind of a big deal in 4 months. Talk about a big change. And so, we see in chapter 3 that there's a rebuilding going on. The rebuilding of the sheep gate, the fish gate, the old gate, valley gate to the dung gate, the fountain gate, horse gate, inspection gate, sheep gate. These were all important gates. These were gates where people would have different roles. I mean, the priest would take animals to the sacrifice gate. These doors were incredibly large. The inspection gate was where the military would come through, and the government officials would monitor them and look at them and inspect them. The fountain gate, obviously, that was the main water cisterns where water was brought in. The dung gate, because you see where refuse was taken out to keep a city healthy. So in these gates are of incredible importance, and they would be named, they would be decorated, they would very ornate, some of them. And so the rebuilding has begun. Nehemiah has arrived in Jerusalem. He has given a speech. He has said that this is not the dream that was once Jerusalem. Let's rebuild this. And so they're rebuilding, and they're doing incredibly well. And Nehemiah chapter 3, what happens is he lists the people. This starts out right away in chapter 3, verse 1, with one of the priests was responsible for working on this particular gate, the sheep gate. And he was a high priest. And so it starts to mention other people who had been jumping in and helping out. There are people from Tekoa, a small town miles away, a small area that responded, and they went back to go help. So there are outsiders coming in to help as well. So now let's pick up in chapter 4. Let's look at 4, and then we're going to start off in verse 1. We're just going to walk through this chapter, if that's all right. So as we see here in chapter 4, verse 1, that, remember, if you were here last week, we introduced the antagonist of this. There was Sanballat and Tobiah. These are people with government positions. They are people who serve the same king that's given Nehemiah the right to go back to Jerusalem. They're not happy. These are people who are going to be incredibly upset that Jerusalem is coming into play. Why? They are losing political control. They're losing clout. They're losing general control of business and trade. And so these people do not want this wall to go up. So we see in chapter 4, verse 1, when Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, he became angry and was greatly incensed. Now, angry and greatly incensed, in other words, is all the commentaries I can break down the description burning mad. I mean, furious. Think about the fury of the fact that he was going to lose this particular area in this city. He was in a rage. And so what did he do? He ridiculed the Jews. That's what you do when you don't stand on a strong platform. You ridicule. You make fun of. You could probably see that this is a tactic still used to this day. You don't need courage to ridicule. You don't. There are great men who could take absolute arrows to the flesh, but ridicule them, ridicule their pride, ridicule their purpose, and they break. They fall to their knees. And people know that. And so what happens is you'll see the platform of ridicule move about as one of the very first weapons of Sanballat and Tobiah. Verse 2, and in the presence of his associates in the army of Samaria, he said, what are these feeble Jews doing? Will they restore their wall? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they finish in a day? Can they bring back the stones to life from those heaps of rubble, burned as they are? Now, so you notice, he takes a four-pronged attack at this ridicule. He also does it in the presence of other people. People, when they the ungodly, when they do ridicule, do so in the presence of other people to get their platform. If we're not careful, we can see throughout churches, and if you've ever seen people burned by churches and burned by religiosity, it's because control freaks, when they cannot control you in a place of work or a place of home or a relationship, they'll run to the steeple. And they'll do their very best to control. When they lose control, watch for the ridicule. This is what's going on here. Have you ever had a time in your life when you've been pointed out? You've been a person who's been the object of that kind of ridicule? I can tell you that one thing, it's one of the greatest growing places you'll ever find in Jesus. For the most part, they'll run out of ammo. Remember, there is no valor and no courage in the art of ridicule. But his points were very well directed. He says, what are these feeble Jews doing? Making fun of who they are. The Jews have always been what we know as a chosen people. But from the day of this to the day of Hitler to the day of destabilization in the Middle East, you've always seen a direction towards the Jews as being those who they're not capable. They're not capable. And so what's interesting is you call a country and a nation feeble all the time through history, and yet through history, no, I don't think anybody's ever had that much thrown against them, and they've stood as tall as they've stood. It's remarkable. The Jewish people are, without a doubt, a people protected, loved, and cherished by God. And so he says, look at these feeble Jews. Will they restore their wall? And then he goes on to, this is another inside jab. He says, will they offer sacrifices? He knew what it was like as the Jews would offer sacrifices. When you have a gate named a sheep gate, when you have a sacrifice gate, I mean, the best sheep were always brought in for sacrifice. He says, are they going to typically offer their sacrifices again? Will they finish in a day? When do they think they can do this? And then also, he comes back to said, are they going to bring the stones back to life? The majority of the materials that were being used to rebuild this wall was the rubble. I mean, I think about, you know, Wes and Ryan, you guys work in construction. If I brought you out, they don't even like coming to my house enough because I'm like, do you think you could do this? Do you think you could do this? But if I took you out to a pile of just spent lumber and warped boards and was like, well, how about an addition out of this? You'd probably think, come on, Jake, you know, get us something fresh. And so these people are building with leftover materials. They feel inadequate enough, and now the ridicule comes. Ridicule also comes at a time and a place where you're hurt the most, where it can hit the most. So sometimes it's easy for us to read this from a place where we're safely removed by over a couple thousand years. Oh, poor Nehemiah was ridiculed. But until we empathize with a man who had empathy for what would be in here. Nehemiah, his entire goal was to build up what we enjoy today. This is a man who, in chapter 1, he wept. And we talked about that. You know, do you care enough to ask? Do you care enough to care? Do you care enough to weep? You know, I always learn things as I go through life in ways you just don't expect. I was getting in my car last night, preached a funeral for my friend Sergio Mendoza. His father passed away. And as I was leaving, you know, I just got so convicted over something. You know, I'm sitting in a car. Went over to the house and his parents' house, and it was just a packed room, all Colombian families and just the sweetness of the people. And as I'm leaving, he's talking, joking around, because you know that's what happens after a funeral. People, you come together in a home, you're relaxed, it's jovial, you almost forget why you're there. And then he just slumps his shoulder, he says, "My dad's gone." You know, and sitting on the street in West Tampa in my car, I couldn't get out of that car quick enough because I realized I knew what he meant by that. That if you've ever lost someone very dear to you, there's a certain pain that just overwhelms you sometimes. In the middle of laughter, in the middle of a sentence, it hits. And you say, "He's not here anymore. She's not here anymore." And then as I got out, I tried to explain. I said, you know, those moments, as time goes on, you'll treasure them. You'll ask God to just give you those moments where just it's just a tidal wave of emotion that'll hit you because it'll bring you back to a place. And you know, he said, "Yeah," and this is where I'm getting at. He said, I keep hearing people say, "I'm praying for you to be strong," and I'm sure I did that in a funeral. But he said, I want to cry. He deserved my weeping. He deserved my mourning. I can tell you, that comment right there forever changed me, and who always is changing in how I impact and how I talk to people who've lost someone, especially tragically. And I learned that sermon that day. You know, Nehemiah found us worthy of weeping. We were worthy and deserving of being wept for. A city of people he had not met was deserving of being wept for. That's a leader. And so while there's people ridiculing and people saying, "How dare you?" here is a true leader who knows how to weep. Verse 3, Tobiah and the Ammonite who was at his side said, "What are they building? Even a fox climbing up on it would break down their wall of stones." So ridicule's contagious. You start to see that one starts ridiculing Tobiah, his just right hand jumps right in, and he, of course, no courage as well, and starts ridiculing as well. But Nehemiah does not respond to this the way he did in chapter 2. In chapter 2, he heard this, and he responded to him. Now, look what he does. Look what it's in verse 4. "Hear us, O God, for we are despised." Did you notice? "Hear us, our God." He immediately goes to prayer. And so Nehemiah starts praying this time as opposed to reacting. He says, "For we are despised. Turn their insults back on their heads. Give them over as plunder in a land of captivity." Now, I don't know if you caught that or not. The Jews, this is called one of the books of captivity. The Jews would consider themselves still captive by the Babylonians. He's actually saying, "Give them over as plunder in the land of captivity." He understands what these words mean more than anybody. "Do not cover up their guilt or blot out their sins from your sight, for they have thrown insults in the face of the builders." He basically says, "God, for all the ridicule that's come from them and come out of their mouths, now show them." You talk about what happens when somebody tries to prank someone and it goes bad and the person knew was coming and makes a fool of themselves. This is what happens when someone says, "Oh, well, do you know about this?" And then all of a sudden, the light is back on, and what happens? They're exposed. How many times have we sat under, in your life, many of you have sat under some angry preachers? "Don't you do this, don't you do this, don't you dare." only to find they fall to the very thing they were warning you and telling you about in such a non-loving way. I know in my life, whenever I've preached angrily, it's because I've been upset with me. There are times which I would get incredibly passionate, times in which I would just share in a way that was just full of this passion. It was redirected, it was directed wrongly. I was directing it towards myself, but channeling it to you because I was hurting. And so here in this particular place, Nehemiah is saying, God, expose them for who they are. So verse 6 reads, so we rebuilt the wall till all of it reached half its height, for the people worked with all of their heart. So the wall is going up. The people are responding. And then verse 7 hits. But when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, the Ammonites, and the people of Ashdod heard that the repairs in Jerusalem's walls had gone ahead and the gaps were being closed, they were incredibly angry. They all plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem and stir up trouble against it. And so here you start to see the people now are starting to... They're taking a ridicule, and they're starting to conspire. They're starting to plot. But we need to learn something, what Nehemiah learned. Do not lose focus on what needs to be accomplished. No matter what comes your way, no matter what directed arrows are against your character, your soul, your purpose, your family, your direction, do not lose purpose of what needs to be accomplished. And so many times, those of you who are parents know what I mean, when you're talking to a child, the child can start redirecting, well, Dad, you know, or Mom, you weren't kind to me, you don't talk to me, and you're in the middle of a rebuke on something, it doesn't work with you. Like, no, let's talk about this issue. You hit your brother with a hammer in the head. So you go back to them, and you're directly bringing them back to that issue. But isn't it interesting? We won't fall for the redirect in that area, but we will fall for that in other areas. So what happens is we start to move ahead, and then people start to ridicule. People start to stand in the way. People start to discourage. And what happens? We give in. We give up. And so don't lose focus on what needs to be accomplished. Look at verse 9. But we prayed to our God and posted a guard day and night to meet this threat. So Nehemiah is now posting guards. He's one who understands what it means to have the strategy of rebuilding a wall, but also the strategy of what it needs to protect the place. So he starts posting the guards, and he knows this threat is only a threat right now. A threat. What typically happens halfway through something big in your life? Discouragement. Halfway through a diet, discouragement. Get halfway through a workout plan, some of you guys working out, you plateau. You get to a place where you're building a house, and all of a sudden what happens? Why is it dragging? You get halfway through a career, and you wonder, what have I done? Have I missed it? And you start to see where discouragement can set in. But here it comes in verse 10. Meanwhile, the people in Judah said, the strength of the laborers is giving out. And there is so much rubble, we cannot rebuild the wall. Catch that again. The people, these are not the Ammonites. These are not the Arabs. This is not the enemy. This is the people. The strength of all our people, we're giving out. And there's so much rubble, we can't even rebuild the wall. Fatigue has set in. The effect of the speeches is long gone. It's been forgotten. And then if it couldn't be worse enough, couldn't be bad enough, look at verse 11. And also, our enemies said, before they know it or see us, we'll be right there among them and we'll kill them and we'll put an end to the work. And Nehemiah has got to be thinking, man, I have... The people in here building are discouraged. They're almost done. They're halfway through, and now they're discouraged. And now I've got a report coming in saying that, inevitably they're going to attack us. And then it goes on in verse 12. Here it is. Then the Jews, another element of Jews, who lived near them, they came in and told us 10 times over, which meant exactly what you think, over and over and over again. Wherever you turn, they will attack us. So he has a threat from an imminent enemy that he knows is there. He has the people living in this city that are now saying we're tired. And then the Jews on the outside are coming in who live near the enemy, and they're coming in going, oh yeah, it's all the talk that they're going to attack and they're going to kill everyone. Nehemiah has to make a decision. No more speeches, no more talk. Action has to happen. And so in verse 13, therefore, I stationed some of the people behind the lowest points of the wall at the exposed places, posting them by families with their swords and spears and bows. After I looked things over, I stood up and said to the nobles, the officials, and to the rest of the people. Now stop right here. Think about this. This is, again, I want to reiterate, Nehemiah, months before, would have never directly talked to a noble or an official, a government official, and here he is about to get up and speak to these people as he's in charge. So again, verse 14, after I looked things over, I stood up and said to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people, do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, and fight for your families and your sons and your daughters, your wives and your homes. When our enemies heard that we were aware of their plot and that God had frustrated it, we all returned to the wall, each to our own work. He gathers them together and he says, we're going to fight this time. And the reason we're going to fight is we have everything to lose. They don't. They come in, they fight, they go back to their villages and their palaces and their wealth and their fields. This is all we have left. Jerusalem is it. If we lose this city, we haven't lost an inch of ground. We haven't lost a building. We haven't even lost the tabernacle. We've lost the hope. We have to fight. So remember. Remember who you're fighting for. Everything in which we are fighting for, we have to lose. When you fight as if everything is going to be lost, you fight a whole lot differently than when you do not. They call that in the throes of death. In the throes of death, people react and they respond and they do what they can. It's amazing what happens. I don't care if it's the adrenaline of one human being in the physical sense of watching what rises up. I don't care if it's a nation called who didn't even know how to react in a time of war. But when everything was put on the altar and everything they knew was at risk, they responded and they replied. Well, makes me think of a thought that I don't know if it works in your life, but it does in mine. Our fear of what could happen is often worse than what does happen. I don't know if that's you or not, but you get these fears. This is going to happen. And then when that moment happens, my fear is 10 times worse than what really occurred. Verse 16, look at the strategy. It gets deeper. From that day on, half of my men did the work, while the other half were equipped with spears, shields, bows, and armor. The officers posted themselves behind all the people of Judah. The people who were building the wall, those who carried materials, did their work with one hand and held a weapon in the other. And each of the builders wore his sword at his side as he worked. For the man who sounded the trumpet, he stayed with me. Then I said to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people, the work is extensive and spread out, and we are widely separated from each other along the wall. Wherever you hear the sound of the trumpet, join us there. Our God will fight for us. Now, he has called together the people, and he has said, now we're going to rebuild, but we're going to fight. And then there's an organized strategy. Nehemiah, we know, isn't somebody who's organizing things. Number one, you don't get a position like you did as an aide, pretty much, to the king as a slave. And then you're going to, when you petition a king, you research to see how much building materials you need and letters of transit you need. So he's researched that. But he's also a man that says, all right, I know this. We have to have a strategy. And everybody has to have a weapon. But obviously, if we get attacked at one wall, the city's large, even though they're only building the southern portion. They've shrunk the size of Jerusalem, the northern and the southern. So they've shrunk it. He said that there will be a trumpet, and wherever that trumpet sounds, we rally. But in doing this, here's what's interesting. Have you noticed he's doing more than building a wall? The stones are going up, but there's something else happening. Community is setting in. This is when obviously people look to each other and they're making alliances. They're making promises. What happens if I die? Would you take care of my family? If something happens to me, would you do this? Can you imagine the sound of walking into Jerusalem at midnight in this time? Lanterns lit up everywhere. People singing songs and talking. The conversations, the excitement. Bows strapped to the backs and spears laid to the side. Everybody wondering and waiting, when will the trumpet sound? And at the sound of that trumpet, that is the place of the attack. And we rally there, we go there. And everybody was still building. And we see the object, here it is. The object was not just to rebuild a wall, but to rebuild a nation. And so Nehemiah knew what he was watching was not just building a sense of community. He was building a sense of a new nation, a new people, a new hope. That's why the fervor went into this. So many times we think we are relegated to our God-given gifts, what you and I can do, what you and I went to school for, maybe what you and I are gifted with, maybe what you and I are told by others, this is what you do well. But sometimes we have to break out of that shell to realize that all things are possible. I mean, when God starts directing us in a certain path, and he starts coming alongside, anything is possible. The inadequacy I feel when I preach the Word of God is something that happens every time. And then I walk up here, nervous, walk up here full of doubt. I walk up here completely uncertain over my own skills. But yet God has me here. God has me doing something. And see, God is like that, that he can take someone who doesn't have formal education and say, I'm going to give you an ability to do something. He can take someone who has insecurities and say, I'm going to give you security in me and make you amazing in every way. God has that way of doing things. And you see that a lot of times in the wisdom. Like I look at people who are gifted in beyond measure in certain areas. They don't brag about it if they're godly. I mean, you get Jack Klim up here who could read this Bible in Hebrew and Greek, and the man said to me one day, we're talking about, remember, Josh, we're talking about the pronunciation of words, and you butchered a Hebrew word. Remember that one? You tried to say, sauerkraut or something. And so, we're sitting here joking with him, like, Jack, these words, we can't get them out. And Jack says, you never lord language over people. Like, wow, what a stud. You know, this is a guy who understands what it means to have the knowledge, but the wisdom to say, you only impart certain amounts that you need to. You don't have to show off. You don't have to be the hero. Nehemiah was not trying to be a hero. That's a true leader. You know, I scroll through Facebook and I always see people who have nothing putting inspirational comments about how to make money. You ever notice that? People on there like, this is do this, and this is what millionaires say, do this, this is what billionaires say. All the people I know who have millions and millions never say those things. They walk the walk. Nehemiah is a man who's walking the walk. This is a man who says, everybody could come to me and say, what are you doing here? And there are people probably in a crowd who said, he was a slave. Why would you listen to him? The man never held office. We didn't vote him in. Why would you listen to him? But he didn't listen to them. Brandon, I was hoping your dad would be here today because I got a quote, and I love this quote. And Dean, of course, is at his mom's funeral. There's Igor Sikorsky. Some of you who know aviation have heard the name Sikorsky. And this was a man who, when he was 12 years old, was telling his parents, I wanted to invent something to do with aviation. I want to do something remarkable. And he sat him down at 12 years old, and his parents said, Igor, we have to explain something to you. Aviation has already been tackled. It's been handled. There are flying devices and aeroplanes, and so there it is. Well, Igor Sikorsky heard that, but he still knew God was taking him a certain direction. And so he invented, anybody know? The helicopter. Exactly. He invented the helicopter. And he hung a plaque on his first manufacturing facility. And if you go on any Sikorsky-run facility to this day, these plaques stand and it reads these words. According to recognized aerotechnical tests, the bumblebee cannot fly because of the shape and weight of his body in relation to the total wing area. The bumblebee does not know this, so he goes ahead and flies anyway. The vision, the recognition that there will be those who say to you, this can't be done. But God has a sense of saying it can be done. Beyond your own physical strength, beyond your own intellectual sensibilities, God can do something. And then here is how I want to wind it up. There are two ways, there's many ways to preach through Nehemiah. Most churches honestly do it as a campaign fundraiser to raise money. Because really, you can do this with this. Oh man, you know, we're rebuilding. You know, $20 for every block. Let's go. You know, and you see people do it as a campaign fundraiser. You know, for leadership training. This is what a leader does. He delegates. He breaks down the assignments, and we start to see that. Man, this is, you know, yeah. There's so many ways this message can go. But I want to bring you back to some verses, and I want to see if you see. When Pastor Jack and I sit down and we walk through a message during the week, it's so cool how he sees things from a different angle, which is why he makes such a great teacher. Some of you come into Hebrew class and you know what I'm talking about. You come to the bridge and you hear he comes from an angle that's what look at the part we miss. Look at the mighty warrior that Nehemiah is calling on. Look at verse 9. Go back to verse 9. Look at this. But we prayed to our God and posted a guard day and night to meet this threat. So the emphasis in this verse is not just, oh, we posted a guard to meet the threat day and night. We prayed to our God. Verse 14, after I looked things over, I stood up and said to the nobles, the officials, the rest of the people, don't be afraid of them. You remember the part about fighting for your families? But how about this? Remember the Lord who's great and awesome. Verse 15, when our enemies heard that we were aware of their plot and that who God had frustrated it, we all returned to the wall, each to our own work. In verse 20, wherever you hear the sound of the trumpet, join us there. Why? Our God will fight for us. You see, the mighty warrior was not the people of Israel. The defensive mechanisms of the wall and the spears and the bows, that was not on the people of Judah. The mighty warrior, the hero of the book of Nehemiah, is the mighty warrior, God himself. That's the magnificence. And you see, this is my last point. The ultimate objective was not to rebuild a nation, but to reestablish the reputation of God to a people who were blind or forgotten. That's the magnificence of Nehemiah, to say, this is a God that I want to show you can do great and mighty things. And so in writing this message, I started thinking about some of you guys who are incredibly hard workers, have your own businesses. You know, I started thinking about, you know, I'm not trying to call you out by any names, but Bob, I thought of you. Brant, Brett, I was thinking about those of you who have, you are pouring into place of leadership in your business. You're pouring into it. And you know, you can be just like a preacher who loves to preach the Word of God. You can fall on your own strengths. And I started thinking, why is it I identify with sometimes with people who have the hard work ethic to want to do things? But I realized that, you know, if I don't pray and feel like I can fix any situation, if I don't feel like I'm inviting God to do something amazing, I'm missing out on the greatest blessing in my life. Nehemiah, without God's direction, would have not have arrived in Jerusalem. Nehemiah, without God's direction, would have never had his brother probably walk in the door. He certainly couldn't have gotten the courage to stand before the leadership. He certainly wouldn't have had the ability to rally people around. And by the way, no matter what, did you notice that no matter what the feeble Jews that the Arabs called them were doing, notice it was the, you'll see later, the fear of God is struck in the hearts of the enemy. Why? Did they change the physiological nature of a Jewish person and somehow have sharper weapons? No, it's the spirit and the power of God that directs itself towards everything in the path of what he intends to do. Starting with you, but not ending with you. That's the mighty warrior we have. That's the ability we have to follow God, to say, God, when I don't see myself out of a way, God, you can make a way. Hope has to have an object. If you just say hope, I saw a sign at the thrift store where I go all the time. So it said hope. I was like, man, I like that sign. And I kept thinking, I wonder how many people view that differently. I mean, we as believers view hope because it is an end to an, it's an object of God, of Christ, that brings hope into our lives. But having hope is about as senseless as saying to someone, somebody's going through cancer, we just send positive vibes their way. Hope in what? Hope that things will get better? Hope that circumstances will change? Our hope in God Almighty, the mighty warrior, in hope in Christ. And so we finish out chapter 4. Verse 21. So we continued the work with half the men holding spears from the first light of dawn till the stars came out. And at the time I also said to the people, have every man and his helper stay inside Jerusalem at night, so they can serve us as guards by night and workers by day. Neither I nor my brothers nor my men nor the guards with me took off our clothes. Each had his weapon, even when he went for water. Next week, in the midst of this rebuilding, we see what happens. Next week we see that the struggles are not over. And so I thank you for walking through this journey in Nehemiah, and my takeaway would be this, that again, the hero of this would not be Nehemiah. If he were speaking, he would say that. The hero is the fact that God is paving a path using Nehemiah to establish Christ in our lives today. So I hope that's your takeaway. Those of you with that strong work ethic, those of you with the abilities to do things on your own, those of you who can handle life. Life wasn't there for you to bear alone. So whatever circumstance, whatever you're going through, I hope you'll call on him. He's a mighty warrior. And by the way, he wants to be called on. What an assurance. Would you pray with me? Father,